At the end of the bicentennial experience, I was exchanging notes with Noeline Miller from GIRA, and she had been chairman of the GIRA Bicentennial Garden. And we both had had lots and lots and lots of people asking questions, showing just how difficult it was for newcomers and enthusiasts to get started. And she said, "Oh, you know, we need a manual." I said, "Oh, I don't know." And she said, "Oh, yes, we do." And she said, "I can't write it. I'll do the illustrations and the photographs, but we need to do something." Well, the manual idea didn't work because there were too many different conditions. So that was why we took districts with different conditions, and we chose good gardeners. We hunted for good gardeners and interviewed them and got their views and their experience, and that was the structure of the book. I was determined, though, to put in as well detailed climatic information for each of those districts so people could see not just the rainfall and the temperature and the frost occasions, but snow occasions and winds and so forth. And the university, of course, had all that those statistics. And Jack Hobbs, who was a professor of geography, a climatologist, he provided us with all those things. So that was very helpful. Just going
now,
back,
the book was called Gardening Secrets.
Yes. I should have said, just going back to the business of the Arboretum, that Maria Hitchcock joined me on the committee for establishing the Arboretum. And she was and is a powerhouse. And she took responsibility for the planning of the Indigenous plant section. But it wasn't just that. And she, of course, had a systematic scheme for New England, for New South Wales, for every other state. She got the local club, Indigenous plants clubs involved in providing material. She also, in the course of doing all this, found that Australia didn't have its own national flower. We all assumed it was the wattle, but it wasn't gazetted. Mm-hmm. And it was her work, background work and research, and Bill, of course, Bill McCarthy helped move that on, and so it, for the bicentennial, the selection, Pycnantha, I think it is, Acacia Pycnantha, was the flower that was chosen because it flowered most widely of all the acacias. So that was the beginning of my very strong involvement with Maria and her enthusiasms.
Well, Maria is, of course, somebody we hope will also participate in one of these interviews shortly.
Yes, I'm sure she will. And
so we have your inspiration for the book.
Yes. And that was great fun. That really was great fun. I think that actually has been a good influence because I know the books have gone round and round through the Rotary Street stall and Ross Burnett's second-hand bookshop. Mm. And because it's people speaking with feeling and knowledge about the things that they like and they don't like. And we put planting schemes in the book and to help people. And so it was great fun to do. And lots and lots and lots of funny stories about that, but that's we haven't got time for those.
And how long did it take you and Noeline to complete those interviews and travel the district?
I don't know, a bit over a year.
Mm-hmm.
she became almost mortally ill. In fact, she died several times, but was recovered. Mm. And that delayed our start. The first big expedition we had was to Tenterfield, and her husband drove her to the junction near Ben Lomond, and I picked her up there. And they said a fond farewell through the passenger window, and he said, as a parting comment. Have you got your magnet? And Nolene said, yes, it's in the glove box. And I started the engine and off we went. And I said, what do you need a magnet for, Nolene? And she said, well, if my new pacemaker, well, it wasn't exactly a pacemaker, it was something very special. She said, if it stops, I just slap it against my chest and it starts again.
Oh, my goodness.
So with that sword of Damocles lurking in the glove box, we set off. And that was just the very beginning. When the book was launched, that was November 1991, Simon and Schuster, which for some strange reason had agreed with Alacrity to publish this thing when they'd only seen one chapter and a few drawings, they said that they had never had such a large book launch. But of course, all the people who were in the book came, and it was November, just before December, and they bought copious numbers to give to all their friends and relations, some of whom probably finished up with several copies that Christmas.
So now, I will cross-reference to the book in the transcript, but just for the record, can you tell me how many gardens were, or gardeners were
in view? I think it was 50, or might be one other side. And we had to be very careful that we were 90% certain that these people we asked would be going into the book, because it would be dreadfully difficult to say, no, your garden isn't good enough, or you aren't sufficiently well informed. So we had to do a lot of spade work before we even approached the owners.
Open gardens, training for open gardens.
Thank goodness.
So did you do that research through garden clubs or personal networks?
Personal networks, really. And Nolene had being a lifelong Armidale resident and coming from a gardening family, she was very knowledgeable. And in fact, she would have been a person you'd certainly interview, because she had a superb garden. She had two arboreta. One was for general interest and the other was specifically for oaks, and that work benefited her daughter and son-in-law at Terrible Vale very much indeed, because they've found that oaks are overwhelmingly the best performers in the retreeing. They might learn other things as time goes on, but it was Nolene's initial interest that made all that possible.
Now, your book was highly successful. It went into two print runs,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, 6 weeks, I think, afterwards. But then an awful thing happened. A new managing director at Simon & Schuster did a terrible clean out of the storerooms, and there was our newly reprinted book. And he sold them off in a huge job lot, I think it was to Angus and Robertson, and didn't offer them to us as the contract specified. And I think Nolene and I both protested very loudly, and they scrambled around and got, I think, 80 for her and 120 for me or something like that.
Oh,
but it was
goodness.
A scandalous thing to do. However, anyway, the book got published.
But there are still many thousands still in circulation around Armidale.
Floating around, yes. Yes, so what was that?
I think the book also brought you into the spotlight for when Australia's Open Garden Scheme was mooted for this area.
Yes. I suppose, I think that was about 1993 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
I had a phone call from someone in Victoria saying that he wanted to visit to look at the prospect of opening, having New England, Northern New South Wales, part of the Open Garden Scheme. And, of course, I was enthusiastic. Turned out that it was Neil Robertson, who was the national director, and John Henwood, who was the manager of regional garden programs on the ABC, or maybe regional radio, I don't quite know.
Do regional radio.
Regional radio. And he had a very particular interest in gardens, and he was a charming, delightful man. And the ABC at that stage, of course, had everywhere marvellous, marvellous garden programs for the locals, with local contributors and local experts being the compeers for the program, and they were an amazing source of advertisement for this projected scheme. In every district, we could get radio coverage, letting people know. So. Yes, it started, and Nan Robertson from Wanderabie at east of Armidale, she was the first coordinator, she was the first coordinator. So we started off with a small group of gardens, really testing out.
Now, you were the first regional chair.
Yes, I was the inaugural chair. And I guess it helped. I knew a lot of people in the town, and I knew quite a lot beyond, because I should say that when I came to Armidale, I met a lot of people who were had been at school with John, and they'd married girls who were very often from here too. And probably my closest friendships stemmed from those times, and the one link we all had in common was that we loved gardening. So there was that, it was a real, it was a way for initially bonding, whether their major interest were other things or not. So that was special. But back to the garden scheme, what did I say about that? I just don't want to miss things. Yes, one of the things I wanted to say was that part of the reason that districts, towns and district gardeners took to it so enthusiastically was that they could see they had an opportunity for raising money for the things they really needed money for the public good. And whether it was air ambulance or their local school or the hospital, they really they seized on it, to the point where when I went to the national conference and looked at the figures that were shown about income, the cities might have earned more in gate takings. They might have, not always, but the fundraising activities that went on within the garden were a pale shadow of what the scheme did in these regional areas, mm-hmm. in both country and the towns. So it was a wonderful facilitating scheme that met many purposes. And it was lovely because you'd find people who lived hundreds of miles apart or hundreds of kilometres, they'd arranged to meet in that set of gardens so that they could have time together and they could do something nice and be fed, not have to provide the food. So it had a big social value as well. So that was good. Yes, thereby hangs a tale because... I didn't open the garden while I was chairman, I think, but I did thereafter sometimes. That time, I think I... No, that's wrong. Just after we retired in 1999, the garden was open. And this was in... late September, and friends from the country were asking me very pertinent questions about the growing of peonies. And I said, oh, well, I answered all the questions, and I laughingly said to these two landowners, all information shared is on the understanding of a future partnership. And 4 days later, they rang up and said, we're serious. However, for completely unrelated reasons, they couldn't go ahead with it. But they said, look, it's a great idea. Run with it. So I then looked about for a place that had good soil and good water and lots of other things that I didn't realise I needed until later, and asked the Philps, who were orchardists, P-H-I-L-P-S, no S, if they would be interested. They didn't know what a peony was, but they soon did. And so then began a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. I'd have to say that the development of that business was one of the joys of my life, although damned hard work. To begin with, John and I, because we'd just retired, we could travel. And we went to Victoria, we went to the ACT, we visited people who were growing them commercially or were just enthusiasts. We had to make a selection of our... Oh, we went to New Zealand, we visited five specialist and commercial growers in November. So as a result of all that, we ordered our first 2,000 tubers from Victoria, and we ordered, I think it was 125 to be imported from New Zealand, and thereby hangs a tale. To begin with, we had to, once we had all this in place, we had to then prepare the soil, and we found that the copper levels were low, and therefore the pH was low, and we came home looking quite blue from hand sprinkling copper sulfate around the place. But there was no agronomist. We had to bring in an agronomist from Queensland. That was the closest we could find to give us some advice. We had to think about the supplying of the water. Now, as it turns out, the Philps land is on that great aquifer that exists underneath the plain between Armidale and Euralla and probably further, which had developed between 15, 60 million years ago when there were volcanoes either side of the of that valley, and the water has collected above impermeable rocks. And it has just sat there. And so there was a wonderful water supply. In addition, the Philps had, because they'd been fruit growers, particularly apple growers, they had cool rooms, which were absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. And they had tractors for the ploughing and the cutting and all those things. And they had a wonderful work ethic, and we were very, very lucky to have them as partners. Our contribution, I suppose, was the fact that we had good business skills, I had plant knowledge, and we had travelled a lot and knew a thing or two about peonies. So we started planting in the winter of 2000, and we harvested our first experimental crop in 2002 or 2003, and we sent samples free to a variety of sites in Melbourne and Sydney to see what their impressions were. And they were all very enthusiastic, because at that time there were very few suppliers. What none of us had appreciated was that, in fact, Armidale sits at an exquisitely satisfactory position in the on the continent. We flower 3 weeks before Gyra, which is the most northerly place to grow for a peony operation, which has since disappeared. And we flowered well before the people to the south. And we'd done a lot of, I'd visited a lot of places in Tasmania over the years, and I could see that they could go into the new year at the higher levels. So they extended the season in one direction, and we hoped to extend the beginning of the season to an earlier date. And that's what happened.
And these were, of course, herbaceous peonies.
These were herbaceous peonies, which is what the market wants. We looked at tree peonies, but they don't yield a lot, and it would have been wildly expensive to initiate the find the plant material. Mm-hmm. So we didn't do that. But I learned a lot about those in China later on. So it was herbaceous peonies. And as the markets grew and demand grew and knowledge of our existence grew, we had some very strange requests. One came from a woman I'd never heard of who said she needed, I think it was 500, maybe 2,000. 2,000 it was. 2,000 blooms on a certain date. What did you need it for? Because we're having the Pizarro exhibition at the Gallery of New South Wales, and I want those flowers. And I said, do you know a lot about peonies? No, 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 she said, but a friend told me that they'd be good. And I said, well, you're going to need a cool room. Oh, no, I haven't got a cool room. Well, what have you got? A friend's stone cellar somewhere in the eastern suburbs. And we're going to store them there, and then take them to the Gallery of New South Wales. And all this happened. They put an enormous net above the foyer at the gallery, and they put peonies in there so the scent came down. And as well as that, they had wristbands for the women with one peony on the wrist, and the gentleman had a smaller peony for a lapel. And I gather there were some rather unseemly scenes as people quarrelled as to which would match what piece of wardrobe best. And there was another Sydney florist this time who was asked by the French Consul General to have a particular flower display for some bigwig's visit from France. And she said, they have to be French peonies. Well, as it happened, we had a lot of French peonies. And she said, I want them red, white and blue. And I said, well, you can have white and you can have blue, red, but you can't have blue. Oh, she said, that's a shame. and she ordered 400 and they put them in towers, I think, at the entrance. And then there was another order that came from ACT, not even a wedding party, an engagement party for 5,000 plants. 5,000 flowers, rather.
My goodness.
That didn't go ahead. I think the engagement might have been broken, but but I told them we couldn't supply that many on one day because we had to honour our other orders. So there were a few of the funny things that occurred. Yes, it was after that, we did a lot more travelling to do with peonies. We went to America in 2007, and we went to Washington, where I swear the peonies were all flowering for our special edification. I even saw them growing up through municipal footpaths. They were so aggressive. Before that, instead of flying straight from San Francisco to Washington to stay with friends, we discovered that the American National Peony Society was having its annual convention in Kansas City. So to my enormous surprise, I found both John and me and my husband attending a convention in Kansas City. And that was an amazing experience because we had people from South America, we had them from Alaska. They all brought specimens because that was the site, this annual convention, which changed states every year. It selected the best new hybrid for the year. And the person who was selected would be a millionaire selling the highly prized plant material. So there was a Catholic priest who was trying to breed a blue peony. There was a bit late for the Sydney woman. People from South America. It was just fascinating. But the most fascinating thing was that the very first morning we had to be at the foyer at 7 o'clock, I think, to drive up into Missouri to go to the home of a man called Don Hollingsworth. And he bred the most famous of the Ito hybrids. And it was just the most wonderful thing, all these devotees of peonies wandering the lines, rather as we had people doing, friends doing when we were growing peonies, but so knowledgeable. And he lived in a house that was quintessential Norman rock wall with, the swinging seat on the veranda and the finials on the steep roofs and so forth. And we sat on hay bales and had our lunch, and the history of how all that came to be was truly fascinating. It started in the beginning of the 19th century when his forebears were in the great move to the plains as that land opened up. And when they got to the Missouri River, they decided that they wouldn't continue with everybody else. They'd stay there and they'd breed horses to provision people for the next stage of their journey into the unknown. And that huge Dutch barn was still there, about 200 feet long. He said that I think it was six generations of the family had been on the land, and every generation meant that the land got cut up smaller and smaller and smaller. When it came time for him to consider how he would establish a viable livelihood, and they weren't breeding horses by then, of course, he realised he had to find some much more intensive type of agriculture. And he'd loved peonies since he was a boy, and he'd been breeding them. And so, although he was an agronomist by training, eventually, when he bred Garden Treasure, the Ito hybrid, he felt he could do it full-time. Maybe he did it before then. But that was a wonderful experience. And then, of course, we went to the gardens in Canada and so forth. But and after that, I went to China. And that was fascinating too, because we'd had a lecture by Lars Tharp of Antique Roadshow fame on the origin of porcelain china at ADFAS. And one of our number, who ran a tour business, said, "They're very interested in this. Do you think you could lead an expedition?" "Oh, yes," said Lars. And I didn't think it had ever happened, but it did. And it was to be in April, and I said to Peter, the tour man, "If we're going to China in April, we also have to do peonies." So the tour became peonies and porcelain. And we started off in Beijing, where they were barely coming into flower in the Forbidden City. And we were to travel west to Luoyang, which is the Luoyang, which has for 1,200 years been the peony capital of China. And peonies were the imperial flower by default, tree peonies. Mm-hmm. And that city has kept to its tradition and its fame for this purpose, because at that stage, back in the 9th century, it was the imperial capital. And we had 3 days there at the beginning of their month-long peony festival. And that was an absolute mind-blower. We went to parks, we went to research institutes, we went to plantations, and saw forms that were just amazing. One of the things that really hit home was you barely saw a herbaceous peony. They were almost grown like grass. It was the tree peonies that were the total focus of their attention. So that was wonderful, and we saw them elsewhere in China, but of course it all paled. One of the things that happened when we were there, we were taken to, this was all last minute arrangements, I think, we were taken to the National Scientific Research Station for peonies, and the director there took us to their centre and cheerfully told us all sorts of things which he would be trade secrets, like how to force peonies, which was to mix up chemicals with alcohol of some sort and have some poor serf stroke the buds at sunrise every day for 3 weeks before as soon as the buds started to swell. And of course in China they were so revered, plants would be put on barges and floated down for the great and the famous to have flowering in their halls and their courtyards, and they'd be just chucked out at the end of it because they'd want a new, wonderful new specimen for the next week or the next day. I've veered a bit from the logical progression, but it does remind me that in 2001 we went to England and we'd prepared for this to go to Kelways. Now, Kelways and some great French horticulturalists were rivals in both importing peonies, tree peonies, and from Asia. And I think herbaceous as well, but the tree peonies were the ones that really caught their fancy, Saffruticosa. And The French bred herbaceous peonies too. Many of their most famous ones, like Felix Cruz and Duchesse de Nemours and Sarah Bernhardt and many, many others, were their breeding. Kelways ran their business. It's still running, still a peony business, and we decided we would go there, and I contacted the manager before we left. And he said, look, I'm awfully sorry, but it's Chelsea, and I'll be really busy at Chelsea, but if you let me know, ring when you get to London, and I'll see what I can do. So he arranged for his land manager to meet us, and she took us round. I went twice, in fact. We stayed a couple of days so that we could, really take things on board. And so she gave us a wonderful, wonderful insight into their production process and their breeding process. And it included things like her saying of this very, very rocky paddock. She said, actually, this paddock is our best performer, and that corner over there is the very best performing zone of the whole farm. And I said, why? And she said, because it was the farm cattle dump for 200 years before we started planting peonies, which meant they loved blood and bone.
Of course, yes.
Yes, so that was an interesting insight. And also seeing them parcelling up tree peonies to go to Chelsea, they were wrapped in cotton wool, the buds, just about to come out, and they were tied with silk ribbons, and they went in the special vehicle. Each day they sent a new plant up, so that it would be exquisitely exposed to view for the visiting public. Some preparation.
What an amazing trip. Yes, amazing trip.
Yes. And there were two other things that happened in terms of travel. I went to Bhutan in 2013, and I went with a group who were bird twitchers. I said they weren't twitchers, but they did twitch. And we went to a valley, Gangte, where the Tibetan cranes overwinter. It's too cold in Tibet, so they go to the Gangte Valley. And it's so cold that even the locals used to move out until they got a little bit of... I don't know whether it was solar panels or what, but they do, most of them stay there now. But it really said something about the cold. And when we went to the monastery up on the hill above the valley, and there were no other people there at all, we were really in wild country, the abbot was a fairly young man who had some English, and I'd been looking at the architecture, and when I went to rejoin our little group, which I think then was 14 of us, they were all considering this scraggly-looking thing in what looked like an incinerator. It was one of those brick space piles with some soil inside. And my friends turned and said, "Do you know what this is?" And I looked at it and I said, yes, it's Pianissa fruticosa. And he said, "Do you know this plant?" And I said, "Yes, I grow them at home." He was absolutely dumbfounded. They had two, an even more miserable specimen was in another part of the courtyard, and this was the only plant material in the court, in the fortress or the monastery.
This is the tiger's nest.
No. That was near Paro. No, this is way up, much higher. He said that these plants were critical to the survival of this Buddhist sect. I said, "How is this?" He said, "Because in the selecting of a new chief abbot, the child, just the way they do for the Dalai Lama, the child must be put through many tests. And one of the tests is that he must be born on a day that we have recorded in this monastery that this plant has flowered." So... truly, truly specific. And they'd kept records for all, 600-700 years. So that was another amazing thing that that I came across. You never know what's going to be around the corner.
Makes me worry about the health of those plants.
Yes, and indeed the future of the sect. And another more recent thing, in 2018... I went with a friend on a Hurtigruten trip up the west coast of Norway in summer, in June. And we had decided we would zigzag back down that enormous peninsula, I suppose you could call it, of land. And I wanted to go to Tromsø, which is in the Arctic Circle. I think it's about 68 point something or other. Frigidly cold, but I knew that it had the world's most northerly botanic garden. And it had a remarkable collection of plants for a position so far north. And bearing in mind that if you looked at 68 degrees south in the southern hemisphere, you'd be on the Antarctic mainland. So it was really, truly remarkable. And the reason, of course, was the Gulf Stream drift that kept the seas relatively warm. Anyway, we went to this nursery. I hadn't made any preparations beforehand. I just wanted to look. And what I found there was just extraordinary. We knew that all of that area, from there to the north to Kirkenes, which is at 72 degrees something or other, it was under 6 feet of snow or ice only 6 weeks beforehand. But because the power of the heat of the sun, which is then 24 hours, things grow, it melts and things grow amazingly quickly. And not only do they grow amazingly quickly, they grow tall. And I saw peonies taller than I'd ever seen anywhere before, at nearly 6 feet high.
That's remarkable. And the climate.
And yes, and at Kirkenes, the furthest most town, there were not only rugosa roses, but delphiniums in flower that had had an even more arduous time of survival, and yet there they were in full flower. And I saw Iceland poppies, true Iceland poppies, very little, but just everywhere, growing like our oxeye daisies, just like that.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that was wonderful to see.
How exciting.
Yes, it was. But the other thing that happened at the Tromsø Botanic Garden was a real surprise. I had stopped to ask two young gardeners what the name of the particular plant was further up in a bog garden. I said, I can't find the label. And one of them said, oh, but there is a label there. Very good English. And they were both on their university long summer holidays from Paris. They were doing work experience at Tromsø. Anyway, he bounded away to find what where the label was. And I talked to the other. And then there hove into view a man who looked, I really shouldn't say it on a recorded program, but he looked like a troll. Hairy, nuggety, shorts, and I think bald, I can't remember. And I thought, oh, we're in for trouble. These men have been talking far too long, and so have I. And he was the director. And not only was he the director, he was the designer. He'd been there, and it had only been there then 24 years. So he was still in transports of delight about what he had achieved. And he said, you know, it's not just plants from Norway or even Scandinavia. He said, all the Northern Hemisphere. And he said, we even have plants, Gondwana land plants. I said, yes, I'd seen them. And he said, we have them from South America and from New Zealand. And even, he said, his voice going higher, Tasmania. And I said, yes, I'd seen them. And one of them was languishing. We went over and had a look at the languishing one. And it was notophagus and forget what else it was. Mm. There was. And he said, you know, I've been doing a lot of reading. And he said, I think that we could grow Tasmanian highland plants because the rock types are similar, similar age, similar periglaciation landscape, which means right on the edge of another glacial period. He said, but I can't get them. I've tried and I can't get them. And I said, oh, well, I think I can do something about that for you, you know, talk about cheeky. And he said, oh, well, I do hope you can. And I got his name and his contact details. And when I came back to Tasmania, to here, I thought, oh, well, I better ring up my friend from university days who was a professional geologist, but her love was botany, and she'd given a huge amount of her life to the Tasmanian Botanic Gardens. And she didn't answer, and she didn't answer. So I then thought, I'll ring the gardens themselves. So the receptionist said, oh, you need to speak to so-and-so, and that person said, you need to speak to so-and-so. And I thought, oh. The third person said, oh, yes. She said, I think that can be arranged. And she said, does he belong to? And she named a professional plant exchange society. And I said, well, if he doesn't, I'm sure he should be, given his the fame of the place. And she said, oh, well, he'll be able to join. She said, just give me his details. So I did. I gave them to her and put the phone down. And a few days later, I thought, I better tell him what I've done. So I emailed to explain, and I had barely pressed send when a neurologistic, drunken email came back. I know, I've been sleepless. I've been reading books all night. So it may be that there is now an exchange scheme, particularly in Tromsø's favour. So that was another lovely experience in the travelling that I did.
Mm. So we haven't, of course, covered your Order of Australia award, Marilyn. What year was that?
Oh, 2003.
Mm-hmm. And
it didn't recognise anything about gardening. In fact, I think
could you tell me what the citation was?
No. It was vaguely political and community interests, but I was embarrassed. It was a nice thing for the people who did it for me, but I think there are many other people who deserve it more.
But a recognition of yes. your community contribution, nonetheless.
The other things, a couple of things I really did want to cover.
Indeed.
Were a more general look at the history of gardening in New England. I don't think people think much about how hard it was for people to garden when they came up in those buggies to begin with no water, no plant material, unless they could bring it on their buggies with them. Only the wealthiest people could afford to import anything, so it was really a subsistence way of life and coping with getting water however they possibly could. I did notice I've continued to notice that the very early homesteads were nearly always very, very close to observable water. That really, unless they were washed out, that really determined the site of the early homesteads. The second really important thing was the arrival of the railway and the fact that it could bring metal, even tanks, pumps, and plant material. This is just looking at the point of view of gardening. That was important. The next really important thing was the business of educating people about gardening. And there was a distinct push at the turn of the century, 19th, 20th century, for children to be taught gardening. Proper gardening, vegetable gardening. Mm-hmm. And there was, I think, a very real understanding in the education professionals at the time that kind of thing, it was a way of helping to get people be better fed. And there are some wonderful illustrations of that at the Hillgrove Museum, photographs. There was a headmaster who was very, very keen, and lots of photographs of that were taken. But there were other things too. Brother Gatty, who was at the Catholic Cathedral, he volunteered to council to park what was a terrible scruffy patch of land called Central Park, and he was actually sent to Sydney to select the plants, which he brought back with him. And he not only planted Central Park, which does still have a tiny bit of an Italian influence, but it's much clearer at the cemetery, where he planted the Catholic section of the cemetery. And there were catalogues as mail services became more reliable. Big seed growers and plant people would send out their catalogues. That was a help. District shows, great deal of showing off, but also education occurred at those, both for men and for women. And I think men were much more involved in gardening then than they even are now, although there are more men becoming interested. And there were the fetes, raise money, school fetes, hospital fetes. They also sort of, I suppose, gave people clues, showed them what was possible and introduced them to new plants, and the garden clubs.
Yes.
But I think with World War I and the Depression and with the breakup of most of the great properties, and the infilling that occurred in town as people had cars and didn't need horses and so forth. Gardening, I think it almost shrank, probably did shrink in many cases. But after the second, well, right at the cusp of the Second World War, we had two, in Armidale, two huge influences that I think we take for granted. The first was the arrival of the Teachers College. There was 107 acres that had to be managed, had to be planned and developed. And they had the great good sense to import a professional gardener, or maybe he was here already, but he trained at the Savile Gardens in Windsor Great Park. And his name was Fred Dye. Now, he was there for a long time, and the roses, the wonderful trees, they are his work, his legacy. He trained up Ned McCann, who a lot of people in town would remember as being a very, very competent professional gardener. And for a long time, he was an ABC presenter. First of all, the college, and then the university, which had an entirely different history of being a great private property with a lot of money available, being gifted to the nation for the purpose of becoming a university college and then independent university. And it had other values, like those magnificent trees, the avenues and the trees around the homestead, and the finish of the place, the deer park, the brickwork, the stonework was all truly admirable, and therefore people to learn from, to appreciate. Sadly, in the last 20, 30 years, its importance in the bureaucracy's view has diminished immensely, and the lack of funds and interest has really damaged the quality of what is offered, although the trees still remain. But for many years, after the Second World War and up to probably the 80s, they were major tourist attractions. Mm. And when the Queen came, they didn't hold a reception at the town hall or wherever. They held it in front of the Teachers College.
We'll just grab a couple of dates here. I think it was for the record. Yes. 1947, the property was gifted to the university. Am I correct?
No, the university started in, I think the first classes were in 1937. Right. It was a college of Sydney University, I think. But its independence, I'm not sure of that date.
And the Queen's visit was 1956.
No. It was another visit. She came in 1954 first, but this was about 1969 or maybe early 70. I guess we could check that.
These things we can all check.
So they had a big impact. The Teachers College crew grew their own seedlings. There used to be big seed beds and glass houses. It was a very special place. So I think it's important for people to realise that we're in danger of losing some of those things. And the other thing I wanted to say about that was that new blood, new thinking, university people, CSIRO people, college people came in, and they brought different ideas and new enthusiasm. And the first effort to replant the arboretum was a crew of those people. What else did I want to say about that? After the Second World War, someone called Alwyn Jones, who was languishing in Sydney, desperate to plant trees that coloured well, he moved his family to Armidale. He was an accountant. but chiefly because he'd be able to grow colourful trees. He found a pal who had similar ambitions, and they had a competition. And they tried to outdo each other. He very quickly moved out of the centre of the town and down in the valley and went up onto the hill to Garibaldi Street. And was phoned one day by his friend who said, "I found it, I found it, the ultimate tree." And Skeptic said, like what? He had a wonderful sense of humour. And he said, "Come and see, come and see." And he said he went down, and he had to admit, this tree just took the cake. And it was Pistacia chinensis. So those two, their competition, saw the Pistacia come to Armidale. And then another group of enthusiasts, including Jack Hilder and many others whose names I don't know, they planted street trees, and they used their own plant material to begin with. And then a town street tree committee was formed, and they were told what they had to plant, but the trees were provided and some help. And formerly, the streetscape of Armidale looked just as bare and barren as, you know, the least loved town. Their initiative, their personal commitment was something that was valued. And another person, one of the Curtises, he planted all the liquid ambers down the western side of the cemetery. And for years, his nephew told me that he had to come with his uncle to water those trees. So there was a lot of personal, unfunded, committed input in those years. This was the beginning of the years after the Second World War that I'm talking about. So I think they're people to be lauded and thanked.
Thank you for particularly bringing those names in of people that should be remembered.
Yes, oh, I'm sure I'll think of lots of others. Yes, in fact, if we can just whisk down a few more to think about. More recently, we've had the establishment of the New England Gardeners Club, a digital club. It has, I think, 4,500 members. Just an extraordinary figure. But it showed that, and this was Lou Forsyth's initiative, it met big needs. People who were time poor, people who needed advice, people who were keen but didn't know where to start things. It's a wonderful facility for people to be able to get an answer to a problem, whether it's a plant type or a pest or a disease or an improvement, or to be able to distribute surpluses of things they have. All those things don't happen easily with the garden club, and the garden clubs that existed, I think, have languished a bit because they've been too kept the form of the meeting more like an English garden club. Not so the native plant people. I haven't had much to do with them, but I'm well aware that not only have they had huge input probably from the time of Dieback onwards, and also in the 1970s, the National Parks Association started, and that's provided a gathering, you know, a purposeful place for these people to meet. But of course, there is the tree group who propagate, and people like John Nevin, who have been powerhouses in the industry, in the field of interest, and Maria, of course, with her enormous imprint. But there were other people too, like Beth and John Williams, both of them academics. And they gave so liberally of their time and their knowledge. John would... Is it? Yes. John would go give talks all round a considerable area, well beyond New England itself, helping people become familiar with their own local plant material. And I know about this because Beth Moore, who lived at Hanging Rock, mm-hmm. so isolated, there was no power and she had to homeschool, she had a natural interest in what was on their place that ran from 4,300 feet down to 300 feet on the Allen River. She thought she had about 96 different species, but she said, I didn't know how to recognise them. I didn't know where to start. And then she heard John was coming to Nundle to have a weekend school on native plants. So she took a bucket of all the things she could find, or maybe several, many buckets, so that he would identify them. And to her horror, he gave her botanical Latin names.
Oh.
And she said, I can't do this. I can't. He said, yes, you can. He said, take it slowly, one by one. You will do it. And he said, your son's started at uni. He said, this is how you make a specimen recording. And if you get stuck, he can bring it up to me and I will help. And that's what happened. And I'm sure he did. That's just Beth's story. And that must have happened right round New England and beyond. So the pair, and they established Beetle Grove almost double-handedly. They were an amazing pair. What else have I... thought I'd like to tell you. Going back to Lou, you know, her latest innovation is the New England Garden Expo. I mean, that is a mammoth thing she's taken on. It remains to be seen how long that will last because it depends so much on the personnel who will commit to it. But it is admirable.
I think this year she's got even bigger plans either side of it to do garden tours, yes, starting at Walker and ending at Tenterfield.
Yes, that is amazing. And just going back on the business of garden touring, I think this garden visiting exercise was really, it took off in the late 80s, 90s. And I think I'm right in saying that it actually started in this garden because a music teacher, a Canadian by the name of Jo Griffith, she taught clarinet, and she was appalled to find that the Stedford Society was defunct. So she drew up a committee of people, and they had to find funds to launch this scheme because it was going to take quite a lot of money. And she suggested to the group that they might ask people to open their houses, people who had the old or interesting architecture. And she asked me, I mean, this house was hardly special, but I said, no, I won't do that, but I would open the garden and I'd offer teas. And that's what happened. So this is where they came for tea and to look at the garden. And following that, she became Lou Abrams, mm-hmm. she suggested to the they develop a cathedral group. And so the cathedral gardens started out, I think about a year later, maybe 2 years later. But it was Jo Griffith's idea of this fundraising in private places that kicked the whole scheme off.
And that predated Australia's Open Garden Scheme by several years.
Yes, yes. I know that there would have been other gardens that opened. The Curtises at Cotswolds and Eynsford, they had regular openings for that were open to the public for fundraisers. I suspect that, well, certainly the hospital did, I suspect that Somers probably had things in aid of NEGS, and there would have been other gardens that opened for their own pet charity.
Just Red Cross or the like.
Yes, yes, yes. But a systematic scheme that went from year to year, I think, began in the 80s. Mm.
So that was that the St. grew into the St. Peter's Open Gardens?
That was Lou Abrams. I think she was the initial chairman, and many, many people, of course, came to help with that, and it became a big thing. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to add, Marilyn? It's a pleasure to deal with somebody who is so well prepared and articulate.
Fantastic.
Well, I'd have been cross if I probably still have missed some things, but I think not. And if you have things you want to ask me.
No, but I would like to go back so Lynn and I can check some of the spellings.
Yes.
We don't need to probably record that. It's just to.
Yes. Yes.